You're listening to the Social Work Me podcast with your hosts, Matt Barnes and Julie Carter.
Oh my God.
Welcome to episode 17 of the Social Work Me podcast with your host, Matt Barnes. And I'm really excited to be sitting down with a former supervisor and colleague of mine, Michelle Young, from London, Ontario. And Michelle is the first and only black person of color in the Director of Service role with the Children's Aid Society of London and Middlesex. And Michelle oversees the agency's Indigenous Services Unit and has been elected by her provincial peers to co-chair the Ontario Association of Children's Aid Society's Anti-Oppression Roundtable. Michelle designs and delivers workshops and training sessions on equity, anti-racism, and addressing anti-black racism for the public and private sectors. Michelle was kind enough to take some time to sit down with me and talk about a whole host of topics, including equity, anti-oppressive and anti-racism practices. We dive into some of the current events in the world, including Black Lives Matter movement, George Floyd, and she gives some really concrete and practical steps that we can all take to be better social workers, better therapists, mental health professionals, and just overall better human beings. So before we get to the show with our guest Michelle Young, just a few quick words from our sponsors. Owl Practice. With everything moving to digital, how do you handle note-taking if not by pen and paper? Owl Practice has all of your note-taking needs built right into their all-in-one practice management system. Type your notes on your laptop or write them out with a stylus on your tablet. You can even create and customize templates to help keep your notes organized and consistent. All of your notes will be stored under each client's profile for easy access anytime. All Social Work Me listeners will get their first month free with Owl using the promo code SocialWorkMe. So head over to owlpractice.ca/socialworkme.php for more details. This episode is also brought to you by Rebel Office, an online resource center for entrepreneurs, including mentorship, strategy building, and graphic and web design services. To get in touch with Rebel Office about elevating your practice, visit rebeloffice.ca and let them know that the Social Work Me podcast sent you to be eligible for discounts and rebates. And finally, this podcast would only be possible with the support of Southwest Counseling Services in Sarnia, Ontario. All right, let's get to the show with our amazing guest, Michelle Young.
How does that make you feel?
Don't social work me.
Oh, it's all good. It's good to see you.
It's been a long time. The last time I thought I saw you was when you helped us out in Strathroy.
Yeah, it was five or 6 years ago now.
So I haven't been there in a long time.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I'm looking forward to catching up with you and finding out what's going on these days and to talk about this crazy world that we're living in as well.
Well, yeah, it's just crazy all around.
So yeah.
And it just kind of merges together.
It really
and collides. And
yeah.
And well, I still do the equity stuff.
Yeah. And that's really why I wanted to talk to you and reach out to you. Yeah. Because this is your thing.
My jam.
And even before really this big movement that's mm-hmm. really grown in the last year, you were a big advocate for this in the workplace.
Yes.
And maybe part of that speaks to how progressive the London Children's Aid Society really is in terms of just even having this position, this oppressive, what was the name of it?
Project Manager of Diversity and Anti-Oppression.
Okay.
So equity.
Yeah.
Right. We were progressive. I think in fairness, like there, if you're looking at across the province, other agencies were farther along and kind of leading the way. I think we somehow put ourselves now maybe middle of the pack sort of thing. Like for sure, Peel back before, so Kika Ojo, who headed up the One Vision, One Voice, provincial for all the CISs, and that was addressing the overrepresentation of Black children and youth in care and the disproportionality as far as outcomes for Black families. She headed that up. So prior to that, though, she also worked at Peel. So they had that particular position. Because I remember someone talking about that position, and that feels like it was probably about 14 years ago. So she was already there doing that. So they have, since she's left, they do have a specific person who's the director of that sort of equity department in a sense. And then they have staff who are also assigned specifically to that. And then there's Durham, who's also, you know, kind of leaps and bounds. They had a person dedicated to that position long before we did. So it's just different. We're all at different stages. And the nice thing about it is that we all work very closely together. And everyone's very free with sharing information, or if I need help, just to call someone, vice versa. It was funny because I talked to another agency a few weeks ago who thought we were light years ahead. I was like, really? And they're like, yeah, you guys are doing this and that. So we had a really good conversation and, you know, sharing information and what we can help each other with. But it was just funny that that's how they saw us. And when you're in it, you're kind of thinking, there's still lots to do. Like we're doing stuff and we can see the response to wanting to have an equity lens for the agency and just a positive response from staff. And then always there's going to be there's always going to be some form of resistance. It's change for mm-hmm. some, right? So that's what the struggle is. But yeah, we are moving. We're not perfect.
Yeah. There's lots of mistakes. Room to grow.
There's lots of room to go. There's lots of, I mean, if we could have a department mm-hmm. assigned to equity, that would be, because it's really hard because there's all these little projects under that umbrella. And some things are, they have a person assigned to it, and some things not really. We kind of just make it as we go.
So what would your day-to-day look like in that position that you were in?
See, because I have the director's position, but then I also have that position. So as far as equity, it's really looking at what have we put out. So for example, we were doing prior to COVID, the pandemic hitting, we were on track to having all staff by the end of June 2020 trained, the equity training. So we do a 3-day, pretty intensive, 3 full days equity training, and it's mandatory. And then there's about a day and a half to 2 days of prep that people would have to do that's kind of online modules that they do leading into that training. So we're lucky because, you know, our director, Chris, and the senior management team really supported doing the mandatory training. So another person that I work with, Steve, we did the, we got trained. So we did the trainer. So we're the trainers for the London office. And so we've seen everybody go through. So we did senior management first, and our ED wanted to be a part of that. And then, which was good because then as staff are going through it, they understand what the demands actually are. Like they need to be able to be present for 3 days. They need time outside of or taking time to work from home. Everybody's working from home now, but the time to work from home to prepare and do the modules leading into it. So having senior staff and supervisors go through that before really sets the expectation for this is what you need to support your staff in. So ensuring that they've blocked off time to do this, taking time to debrief with them after, because it's pretty heavy stuff. Mm. And so that was pretty exciting. So at the end of February, we had just over half the staff that went through. So once the pandemic hit, we then decided, okay, what else are we doing? Because we were doing other things, like there would be journal club. So we'd ensure that that was an ongoing thing that they had. So we would provide an article and sort of maybe facilitate the discussion around that. We've attended staff meetings. We've done consults for cases, private consults, just people who have gone through the training or haven't even gone through the training know that this we're doing, saying, I'm struggling with this aspect. And so a lot of it because of it's equity. So it's not just you put it on the shelf after, you know what I mean? Like here's the standards training for, you know, meeting your 7-day response, doing this and okay, I'll just put it on the shelf and when I need it, I'll just refer back to it. It's a quick little reference and I'm good to go. This is the beginning and you have to keep feeding it because you just think that you've had all of this time to be operating without an equity lens or operating with anti-Black racism sort of at the heart of everything. And how do you move through? It's not I went to the 3 days of training and I'm good. It's literally getting people to understand it's an ongoing. So the one person that I did a consult with, some of it was, well, really it was them looking at what was happening in their personal life and how they were responding to certain things and thinking, I think I might be a little racist. Now, how is that impacting when I'm working with other families? So I was really impressed with that person for A, being aware of it, and then B, even reaching out, because that's a pretty vulnerable place to put yourself in. And they didn't know me very well. Like, I did the training, so they knew me for the 3 days, see them in the halls, hi, bye. But to sit down and say, here's my stuff, help me walk through this. So spending that time with that staff, I think, was really meaningful. And I took a lot out of this, just that, okay, we're doing some good work here, that it's causing people to think and realize that this isn't just stuff that you do on the job. Because unless you're not thinking about it outside and it's not impacting that way, there's no way you can apply it to the way that you need to, or to be as useful in that space as you need to, because I always tell people, you're the tool, like you're it. It doesn't matter what policies, I mean, we're going to put policies, don't get me wrong, we're going to put policies and things in place. Like, you know, we have laws of how to drive your car on the street, but at the end of the day, it really comes down to that person and their personal responsibility. And so how do you work with a family understanding what your identity is and how that comes into play with the work that you do?
And that's so important with child protection. I mean, oftentimes you're the only one observing these families and these cases, and it's so subjective.
Oh, yeah. And not understanding. So there's subjective in the sense of your take on that child, that youth, or that family or parent. Mm-hmm. But in equity, we're really asking you to look at, what is your role in this? You're not neutral. Your identity is not neutral. So if you're working with a family that happens to be, let's say, their background is Indian, they're from India, and you're a white person coming in, as soon as you come into their home, they are making already a quick check of who they're going to assess you to be. You drove up in such and such car. This is how you speak. You obviously have this level of education. How much contact have you had with an Indian person? We're from Mumbai. Do you have any contact with people from there? And I'm first generation, da da da. Like, all of these things coming into it. Or are you just coming to tell me how I'm a poor parent and what I should do? And do you care what parenting was like and how my parents parented me and how there might be a cultural clash happening here? And do I have this impression as the person in brown skin? Do I have this impression or belief that you just want to assimilate us? So as opposed to both sitting down and talking about, I'm not Indian. This is what I'm coming with. So I can do my homework, but as we walk through this, there's going to be possibly things that you need to check me on. So I need to make sure that I'm respecting your culture, and there's going to be parts that, yes, I will go research, but then it doesn't say this exactly who you are. So how does that sit with your family? What does parenting look like for you? Because I think everyone wants to do what's best for their kids. Does everyone have the capacity and capable? Unfortunately not. Right. But if we don't even understand what the issue really is or who they are and understanding who you are in that space, that's the big thing. Because I think people, and post-civil rights, that was the thing, right? Don't see color. I treat everybody the same. And there were public service. Like, we went back and there's from the 70s. There's like public service things that came on TV that basically said, you don't see color. Like, that's a bad thing. This is how we walk through the world. So it wasn't just like a family sat down and said, no, we don't talk about their color. I know Michelle's black, but we don't say that. Just say Michelle, right? And like, well, yeah, but she, no, we don't say that. And there'll be staff or people in training who have shared that, how the impact or the response was when they referred to someone's color in their home. So it was a white staff and predominantly white staff who were saying that the response that they got back is, you don't do that. And I just thought, okay. And then now, you know, we flipped it and we're bringing you to a space saying, oh yeah, we do that. With intention and with understanding that encompasses a part of a person's identity. And you have to acknowledge that, because walking with that, you can make certain assumptions that maybe Michelle has experienced racism because she's black. Maybe she's experienced sexism on top of that because she's a woman. And how are these things intersecting? But to say, I don't see colors, almost to say you don't see that I'm a woman either. which is a little problematic, right? Yeah. So it's not to say to get honed on that or use stereotypes, but to understand that with some of those, some of these identities that are marginalized, pushed to the margins, that there are forms of oppression that people are going to have experienced. And when you're saying, I don't see your color, you're saying you don't see me. Mm. Right. Really, it's somehow that's negated. That part of my experience doesn't matter.
That's a really, that's a great point. And I mean, I left the agency before this equity training was offered, but I remember, you know, one of the hot topics in terms of kind of cultural differences was co-sleeping. In terms of child protection and, you know, families coming from other countries where that was the norm, right? Where you have, you know, multiple or maybe many children sleeping in the same bed. And that was a real thing that we had to sort of take into consideration, the cultural implications of.
Yep.
So
I'm just going to smile.
Okay.
It's complicated because... Yeah. I think if there are other factors, so I'm going to speak as Michelle.
Okay.
All right. Michelle speaking. Michelle, Jamaican Canadian, born in Canada, Michelle, that totally understands the need to have these expectations and these standards, but also realizing that people need to be able to really assess the situation. Are there other factors that play into this? Like you've got a parent who's overtired, who might roll over. Like all of these, are there drugs? Is there alcohol? Is there mental health? All of these other things. Because yes, children sleep with their parents' family in majority of other parts of the world as a regular, and children do not die. Not say ever, but that isn't a regular thing. And why is that? Right? So my concern is always, and I worked in the booth where we took calls, right, for a short period of time, and got lots of calls on that. And my concern was always just, okay, what are we creating here? Because culturally, that's what people do. So I remember I worked with this one family when I was in Toronto working, and they, a young couple, and she was Korean, living in Japan, and the father was Taiwanese, I think, had lived in China. Like, it was just this interesting mix. And when their parents came together, we had to have interpreters. We had to have interpreters because they couldn't communicate back and forth. And sleeping on the floor on a mat was the norm. And I'm thinking, well, this baby's not rolling anywhere, right? Like, they're just going to roll. And it was baby who wasn't rolling. So I really had to go back at that point and talk to my manager, because the question was, do they have a crib? They were about to get on a plane in 2 weeks and go to Japan. And so I really had to do some education around that piece and why that in this situation with that agency, that this was an okay thing. But I think it's important that we don't start to marginalize people because it's about poverty or it's about a cultural difference. So yes, we can afford a crib, but we just don't do cribs. Okay, so let's talk about how this child can be safe. What's the age? What's this? Does the child have health issues? So there's so many other factors, because once you walk through the family with that, they might be in total agreement at that point. Say, you know something? That might be the better way to go. Mm-hmm. But I don't want us to just stop short with they're not protecting or there's some sort of neglect happening here. The other one is, how many rooms? Does everybody get their room? I'm like, people come here and just think that, like, Canadians, they all live in these mansions and everybody's got like their own wing, right? And it's like, well, so-and-so sleeping at their other parent's house. And that parent, like, I have two kids, one's a girl, one's a boy. They're 5 and 7. And they only have a one-bedroom apartment. And I'm thinking, why are you calling?
Yeah.
That's not a problem. And I'd say to them, I'd be okay if they had a studio or a bachelor. And then there's like, what? I said, do we have any other underlying concerns? Mm-hmm. Because in many places in the city, homes, kids share rooms,
right?
Kids share beds. Sometimes it's about income, sometimes it's not. That's just the culture of the family, whatever the case. But we're not coming and swooping in about that. Mm-hmm. And then as they get older, if you can't accommodate having another room, do they have privacy? So my concern is just, when they need to have privacy, do they have privacy? They put a note on the door, one goes to the bathroom to change. Because I always think we're coming with a very, I don't even want to say Eurocentric, sort of Western way of thinking, in a sense, that I said to someone who that was, they did some work for the OCL, and that was one of their questions was, I'm working with this family and like one parent's concerned because they don't think there's enough privacy. And, you know, I think the other parent was just more free with their body. And I said, is there any concerns about any in anything inappropriate sexually? They said, no. And then I was like, I don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
Okay. This wasn't through my work. This was a friend who worked. And I said, okay, I'm joking, but here's the thing. In our house, we're very free. There's just three of us in the house. And I said, it can't come just down to your level of comfort. Because I said, if you go to, when we've gone on vacation and it's on a Caribbean island, you will see the mom and the daughter topless, you know, to the shock of a lot of other people. And in those cases, the families that we've met, they were from Germany, and that's what they do.
Right.
And I said, I don't think at any point that as this is happening in that culture, that they're saying how inappropriate that is.
Hmm.
So I always think about those things. Are there other things happening? And that's not to say that sexual abuse isn't happening in those countries. Absolutely. Like sexual abuse doesn't discriminate, but let's not just jump to those thoughts and those assessment of that situation. And I think sometimes when we work and operate where we are, that sometimes it's the quick, it's like an audit. Well, this must be going on. Well, not necessarily. And I think I freak people out because I'm like, well, there might be another alternative hypothesis. Not saying that's not happening, but let's unpack that. Dad years ago in intake, he was, they were Korean, so they bathe together. So I said, okay, I need to read up on this. I'm not going to go out there and tell these people, you need to do X, Y, Z. So I actually did read up. I spoke with someone, and it's not to say that there isn't abuse or something happening there, but I cannot walk in with that at the front. I have to have done some homework, and then I know what questions to kind of ask to try and figure out if that's literally what it is and when we're going and interviewing the child as well. Because if you put your blinders on, yeah, does daddy wash you? Yep, you know, and all of those things is just a straight line, yeah. You know, and that's when people will get their backs up against the wall and they will start to accuse us of not respecting their culture or making stereotypical assessments of them.
Mm, that's such a good point. And I think just re-looking at our own definitions of safety. And, you know, one of the cases I went on when I was doing some contract work with you was, it was a family in London, and the call was about this father, I think he was from Indonesia or Thailand, was putting his child, young 5 or 6 year old, in the back seat with no car seat. Right. And I don't know if you've ever been to Indonesia or Thailand, but they drive around on mopeds with like 3 kids on the back, mm-hmm. no helmets, and they're flying through, weaving through traffic.
Yep.
Right. But our definition of safety is a car seat with, you know, the 2-point, 3-point harness or however it all mm-hmm. works. And we have these standards that, you know, don't account for other people's cultural differences and norms.
Yeah. And I think it's, and then it's just the education. So instead of jumping to, and I think in a lot of instances, we don't jump to these are neglectful parents. I think that we jump to, okay, so what's the safety? So explaining that to people, because I mean, we go to Jamaica. Car seats are more visible now, but when we first started going, our son's going to be 9. So when Macklin was younger, we it was a pain. Like, you lug this thing from Canada, you know, I got to check it, got to get it. And then I think we had like a playpen. It was just like, oh my goodness. Now it's just like, here's your knapsack, get on the plane. Right. Whereas then it was all of this stuff, but recognizing we are going to be bringing our standard, our expectations there, because we know the safety behind it. Right. So I think it's, we take time to educate, as opposed to, I wouldn't want people to feel that they're being shamed or their culture is being negatively critiqued, because remember, I'm positive that when my mom left that hospital 50 years ago, she sat in the front seat. They walked out after they took her out of the wheelchair. I think they wheeled her out, right? Yeah. And then they handed her baby in the front seat. She probably didn't put a seatbelt on because it was tucked in between the seat because nobody wore them.
Yeah.
Right? So whenever I used to do frontline and talk to families, I would tell them what it used to be like here, and they are in shock. And so we talk about lack of supervision. And I'd say, well, okay, so what was it back home? Or what was it like, even not even back home, but the community that you came from? And they would say, well, the adults are out, so they're watching the kids. So it would mean I just send my child out, but I don't have to go and check with Matt. Can you watch Macklin for me? You just do. And when you send your two out, and they could be like 3, 4, 5, you know I'm out there, you just send them out. So people come and they're living sometimes in complexes and they send them out. And then their neighbors are like, what is going on with these people? And they watch it once or twice. Instead of just going and talking to them, they call us. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we come and we see the little people out. So it's not even a question of, are they unsupervised? Like, come here, are these yours? And they're like, yeah. And sometimes out of fear, they might lie, or because now there's just authorities coming. And I will say to them, oh, no, this isn't about you being a bad parent, because when I was growing up, my mother wouldn't have known where I was. You just didn't. Mm-hmm. You went for a walk. You just went. We went bike rides. We were down by the ponds. Like, you just did these things. So when I'm looking at them, their eyes are like, okay. And I said, but then things shifted and people weren't as much raising as a village. And even though I didn't know your child's name, I would still stop and offer assistance. We're walking down the street, and if we were acting up, somebody would stop their car and say something to us, right? And you don't know them, but people aren't doing that. So really explaining to people where this is the cultural shift for them, where we're at now and why. And then they get it. So maybe you want to connect with your neighbors so you can trade off. And so there's this understanding. And then they're always saying, well, why didn't they just come say something to me, right? The neighbor.
Yeah.
So that just speaks to how disjointed we are as a community. But I think it's breaking those things down that we weren't always like, you know, sometimes we've got this stellar way of being in these standards. Things had to happen for us to get there. And so I always want people to understand that that's why seatbelts are mandatory. Remember when I don't know how young you are, but when like seatbelting became the law, people were losing their minds. Like, it's got to crease up my shirt. Like, what? And then when you had to put your baby in the back seat, I think that was like a 90s thing. Because before, you used to be able to put your baby's car seat in the front seat next to you. Remember? And then predominantly moms, because they were the ones who were caring for the children in that way, going from daycare to here or there, they're just like, well, how am I supposed to feed them? Like, you're supposed to be driving. Well, because then I just put the bottle in, or they just do this. It's like, you want them back there. And then we wanted rear facing.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Like, they did 1 year, my son went for 2 years. So it's just like, yeah, I'm just going to go to the extreme and you don't know any different. Right. So then we wanted rear facing car seats. Like, so now it's real. Then they had to make these mirrors so you could see them, but they never really worked. Remember that? So I think it's important when we're talking about different cultures, what really are the bottom lines?
Mm-hmm.
And that begs to having workers understand different cultures, or being open to being educated about different cultures. And some of that education is going to come from the family. And then if you need to, you can double check things, but it's, we're this melting pot, this multicultural community. And people, we have to be very careful. Is this something that really is a child protection thing? Or is it a cultural thing? Is it a religious thing? And trying to unpack all of that to ensure kids are safe and people's cultures and identities are being respected.
Hmm. I like it. Ellen, I think there's a lot of new terms that I've definitely heard of this year. And to be honest, equity is a fairly new term for me in this mm-hmm. context. Can you... Yeah. Before we kind of move on to other topics and things, can you just briefly talk about equity?
So when I think about equity, I like comparing it to other things, because people would have been possibly more familiar with diversity training, inclusive, being inclusive, and then equal. So are things not just equitable, but just equal? So they used to talk about the boys on boxes. So there's that photo, which now is being kind of pulled, which I agree with. However, I'm going to use the example that because of historical things, because of other things, everyone is not on the same playing field. Or if we start off, there's one that went through Facebook where it's a race. And so they've got all these different people, different identities mixed in this race. Just out on the field, they're going to race. And someone comes along and gets to tell you where you get to start, right? And based on certain things. So if you identify as gay or lesbian, you're actually going to be back here. Now, if you're gay, lesbian, and black, well, we're going to push you a little further back. Now, if you're a white, heterosexual male, you're probably going to be at the front. And that's going to be based on sexism, racism, every sort of ism, or the fact that white supremacy, and I don't mean people running around with hoods, but just that everything, that is the default. That is what you're supposed to aspire to. And that's how it's been set up. So when you're talking about equity, before you used to think, well, everyone got a fair shake here. You know, Michelle got 10, Matt got 10. What's the problem? She's just not working hard enough. And then you start to realize, no, there are other factors at play. So there are things like systemic racism, unbiased racism. So because you grew up in this society, there are beliefs that you will hold about another identity consciously or unconsciously, and a lot of it unconsciously, and it's being reinforced. It's being reinforced in things you see on TV, things you read. I go to school, my son goes to school. Is he seeing pictures of himself as the doctor? So as he walks in, what is he being told right away? When we go to the doctor, what color is the doctor? What sex is the doctor? The teachers. So what's being constantly reflected back? So how do you walk through the world and not, let's say as a white person, just take that in? You have no reason to question it. Sometimes people do. There's like really cool white people. They'll question it. But there's so many forces that go against us. And we're talking about everyone got. So you'll hear people say, well, I was poor. I was this. I'm white. Well, I worked hard, yet just didn't have this additional thing on top of it. So are there things that have to be done to address what's caused it to be unequal or inequitable? And so one thing we talked about in child welfare, so I talked about the One Vision, One Voice. And so that was a project and at the provincial level that was run through OACAS. And because for over 50 years, I would say, the Black community in Canada, in Ontario, a large part also in Toronto, kept saying, you have way too many of our kids in care. You automatically make assumptions of Black families, and I'm going to be stereotypical here, Black Jamaican families, that they hit their kids, da-da-da-da. You've made all of these. So when we now interact with your system, we don't fare well. Our kids come into care more. You don't explore kinship the same way. You decide, well, this is person's situation. We can't deal with the family. And they stay in care longer. You don't have as many foster homes that are reflective of this race. You don't, there wasn't time being taken to address that culture or anything like that. So there's all these assumptions made. So two parents, one Black, one white, same reason coming into the system, the white parent is going to leave sooner, the outcomes are going to be. And that doesn't mean that white children do not sit in care long time. That doesn't mean, but when you're looking at the disproportion, that's when you really have to look at numbers and see what's happening. Because what they found was Toronto, I want to say it's about 2013, 2014, Toronto CAS were brave enough to release their stats. And that's the thing. If you are not the holder of this information, you don't have control. So although the Black community had a lot of anecdotal information, they didn't have the numbers. So who held the numbers? A predominantly white, well, a white system. So finally they said, okay, we're going to release. And it showed that Black people, or those who identify as Black, made up about 8 to 8.5% of the population in Toronto and Greater Toronto. And at the time, made up 42% of the kids in care. And if you look at the Indigenous stats, Indigenous make up how much of the population? And more than, like, it's, so you can't say that everything's equal. Because if you did, then that would mean that Indigenous parents are just bad parents. Black people are just inherently bad parents. And white people are stellar parents. Because if you make up 80% of the population, you white people should wake up 80% of the kids in care. So that's when we're talking about equity, being equitable versus just being equal, right? That there are things that are going to have to come to play. So now putting equity training into the agency to say, we have basically causes to continue. We are the creators of this, because people are looking, even their standards and things that we're looking, we have to revamp and relook at these things to say, are they inherently systemically racist? Yes. And so, but then people are also coming in with their own experiences, their own lens of the world. And if you're a good parent, you will just do X, Y, Z. Because it's as simple as that, right, Matt? I don't know.
It's not. It isn't. And there's so many thoughts I'm having right now. I guess one of them is, you know, do you see this going in the direction that we've gone with working with Indigenous populations in the sense of, you know, there's a whole team dedicated to working with the Indigenous communities in London. You know, the training, the new worker training to be a child protection worker had a, I think it was a whole day component of Indigenous culture and, you know, history in Canada.
There's an actual training. So our agency had embarked in a 2-day training and I had participated that back in January. And then with COVID that stopped, but there is, pieces of it in the new worker training. There is a standalone training. There are other things done to support that training. And when you say, do I see it going, do you mean specific to the Black community? Yes. In a sense? Yeah. There are some agencies that have staff who take on predominantly the Black files. And, you know, I'm always mixed about specializing. I get it. Because right now, if you're talking about with Indigenous communities, that there is staff who are comfortable, who know, because there are different protocols and things, so they're more familiar with it. I don't want other staff, though, to think this doesn't apply to them. Because ultimately, what I see is that regardless of where you are in the agency, if you're able to look at things through a lens of not being anti-Indigenous, not being anti-Black, anti-oppressive, that it doesn't matter who you are and what case comes before you. But I don't think we're there. So then we have these. There are a few other agencies. Our agency doesn't have that right now, but we do have a supervisor who welcomes those cases, who identifies as Black. But at the same time, everything can't sit on that team and can't fit on that team. So when there has to be an overflow or something like that, or the case just ends up somewhere else, they have to be getting that same level of service and they have to be looking at things through a lens, really questioning anti-Black racism. To move things forward. And it's a shift. And for some, it's a shift. There are some staff who that already was how they were operating. Either they've taken a course. I'm not going to say a course, because a course is one thing. I think it might spark and get you to think critically, but it's an ongoing thing that you have to continually work at. Like I think, because I say to people, I'm a Black woman. I've been Black all my life. I do training, I do equity training, I do workshops, I participate in different panel discussions and things like that, which I love and enjoy doing. But I also have a lot of stuff that I read and a lot of stuff that I listen to on a regular, ongoing, that's my passion, that's what I love. But I always think about if someone's struggling with something, I want to understand what that struggle is if I'm not, especially not of their identity, or even if I am, because I've had conversations with Black friends, Black staff. I just don't get this. Why can't they? Why don't they just understand this? And I understand why they don't. So the more that I educate myself and understanding, is there a different way I could explain this? Or I liked how they use that word. It's an ongoing, or I never thought about that. Or the fact that I, you know, oversee the Indigenous unit now. And that I was fortunate to get that sort of role back in the spring. But at the same time, I'm walking in going, I'm not Indigenous. I've never worked on the Indigenous team. I do operate, it's just who I am as an anti-oppressive person. However, I immediately went out and started reading and looking things up and incorporating things so that they're a part of our lives, like in my home. So I'm telling people, you know, this needs to be outside these four doors of this workplace. I'm not just saying that because I think you need to do that. I say that because that's how I walk and it seems to work. So today is Orange Shirt Day. Mm-hmm. And so a few years ago, I had ordered this book, which obviously came out this week, earlier this week, and talking to my son about that. So, and going over, tell me the story. Who's Phyllis? And walking through. I don't remember this. I remember. So going through it again and having those discussions and making those discussions real beyond. He's not an Indigenous child. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he has any Indigenous friends in his class, but he knows how he feels about how people that are Indigenous have been treated. He's not cool with it. And he questions things. And so raising him to be comfortable questioning those things, not just things that will impact him because he's a young Black male growing up, but because these are going to impact your friends, your one friend who has two moms, right? People aren't going to like him because of that. People aren't going to like your other friend maybe because he is Indigenous. So how do you stand with them? How do you, what's your role in that? So we bring, like when Steve and I do the training, we bring a lot of our personal stuff into the training. So it's a lot different than other training because my thing is, if I can't get you here, this isn't going to happen. Because like intellectually, yes. Because intellectually, you're going to know, well, oppression is wrong.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say the N-word.
Right.
Right? And if they're not from India, I probably shouldn't call them Indians, right? Like, and then that's it. I'm not racist. I'm done with this. So I think the murder of George Floyd was very, it was awful. But I think what came of that was interesting that, and I think COVID had a lot to do with it, right? People were forced to be home. So they had to bear witness because for people who identify as Black, we were just like, okay, there was a mourning that happened. There was a sadness that happened. There's a mourning. There is a true connection to, I have a husband. I have a son. I have a nephew. I have a brother-in-law. I have a brother. I have a friend, right? Who is Black, who is male, Black women who also are being killed. And then it was all of a sudden the non-Black people kind of woke up and were like, really? It had to take, okay, fine, we'll take it. Mm-hmm. But it had to take like the actual witnessing of like breath being taken out of someone's body because this isn't the first one.
Right.
Because remember, even leading up to George Floyd's murder, you know, you can't jog while being Black, like all of these things. And we're thinking, okay, if this is what's causing not just those in the US and Canada, all around the world to wake up and protest, okay. Mm-hmm. And I know that we will lose some people along the way. They will become tired. And some people became tired within 3 weeks. And it will go, but at least it's brought the conversation to the forefront that you're going to have to discuss this regardless of what sector, realm, piece of this space you occupy, mm-hmm. right? It's bleeding into, and some will do it. There was one thing that you had said, one thing you had wrote. What was it? He's going to ask. Yeah, it was a term.
Virtue signaling? Or
yeah. So is that like when people are like putting them up on Facebook and what they think is the politically correct?
Yeah, okay. It's sort of like, it's a move that it's disingenuous and it expresses kind of your moral values, but the intent's to kind of pump up your own image.
Right, right. So that's when really questioning people who are very posty, I'll say, on social media. And I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big poster of things on social media. I probably should be. But then I'm like, hey, then what are you doing though in your real life? What conversations are you having? I'm not asking you to necessarily go join a protest, although we did go. I'm not asking you to like set a building on fire, but in your own space, what are you doing? So if you're saying I am an artist, and that is your thing, then where do you cross over and intersect with other cultures? And is there a way for you to acknowledge, to ensure that there is space for other voices in the space that you occupy, right? So if poetry is your thing, are you making space to hear those voices? If it's child protection, how are you making space? And for some people, one team had a book club. So the team just decided early on, we want to have a book club, White Fragility. We're being told we should probably read the article or watch the YouTube, Robin DiAngelo's book. And so they did that amongst themselves. So when I'm saying they don't have to be these huge things, but it's causing you to question when you're sitting in case conferences, it's causing you to question. Sometimes people are coming back from a home visit or back from a meeting and saying, that didn't sit well. What do you think about this? Okay. And then I say, go back. Some things in life, there aren't do-overs. Right. Like if you choose not to attend that wedding or go to that funeral, I always say there's no do-overs. This, you get a do-over. You go back and say, yeah, I dropped the ball on this. Last time I was here, you said this and I totally did not. I dismissed it felt like or whatever. Or you said the school was being racist, but I was really focusing on this child protection reason why I was here. But I want to hear about that. I want to hear about how your family or you are being impacted by this, or how do you think that you, because the two things can exist in the same space. You can have a teacher who's exhibiting racial biases or things, or just being blatantly racist, and there could be child protection concerns, right? So one might lead you to call more quickly on me than on Matt. You might go talk to Matt about the situation. You might just call on me because you perceive me to be an angry Black woman, right? So it's really just in these little ways, how are you bringing this thinking into your being? Because it's hard, because you're constantly being pushed back. You know, when you look at what's in media, how are things being shown in media? What books are you reading? What books are your children reading? What things are being focused on as far as the story of the day? Mm-hmm. How are racialized bodies being portrayed? Right? Yeah.
The perspective that, just to go back a couple minutes, that you were talking about, like getting people here in their hearts, mm-hmm. you know, that rings true. And I can think of some personal situations where, you know, I'm talking to other white males, heterosexual, you know, we're the poster children of white privilege. And, you know, I had some great experiences work-wise and just in life when I lived up in the Yukon. And I was working with primarily First Nations youth mm-hmm. and children, and seeing the impacts of, you know, the 60s scoop and residential schooling and, you know, the trauma that they've experienced. And, you know, one memory I have with talking to somebody about the issues that some of the First Nations communities face in Ontario actually almost led to like a fist fight, because I was so passionate about, you know, understanding the trauma piece, and that we can't, sort of the take home message that I had was he didn't understand and couldn't connect from a heart level with what this population had endured. So we couldn't really have the conversation that we needed to have. He's jumping to solutions and trying to, you know, dictate sort of the plan that they should take to get out of this slump or whatever you want to call it. But wasn't able to connect to it on that level where he could sense or be empathetic with the pain that they'd endured.
Well, it seems like he still saw himself as a colonizer.
Basically.
Yeah. Let me come and fix you people, but let's remember how things came to be. Yeah. And I think within the training, the one thing about it, like I know people are having to go virtual, and some of us have been very resistant that we can't do this kind of training virtually. And it's not saying, oh, we're all that and we're great. It's that there's things that happen that are not overt, that are quiet, that are happening to participants in that space. And the fact that you can truly connect with someone and see what's happening to them, that you're not disconnecting by A, not having your video on, or you might be chimed into something else for all I know. Maybe you've got it on mute. But when you're in the room, and I tell people no cell phones, that they're off unless you're on call or something like that, because when someone's sharing something and you're there, they're checking out, they're done, right? Mm-hmm. And you're not getting all that you can. And a lot of times we've had where we had a white staff who was sitting next to a Black staff, both had sons, and Black staff was sharing just, you know, they're from another country, but the naming of their child, that the name, do they go with a traditional name? They decided to for their kids, but then went with middle names that were Anglo in case they needed to use them, and what it's like, you know, having to deal with certain things. These are professional staff in this room, but having to deal with, so you're not saying other factors are playing into it, right? But having to deal with the school because of their identities and dealing with these issues, and having the white staff, I don't want people in tears, but it's an emotional, heartfelt thing, because finally now you're thinking, I don't have to do that for my son, right? I don't have to do that for my son or my nephew or anybody like that. I don't have to have that conversation.
Right.
And then to put themselves in that shoe, to think to have that conversation, to have every time I think anyone's child leaves the home, doesn't matter how old they are, there's a certain level of stress for the parent. Mm-hmm. But the added stress is not this. The stress is, I hope they don't get into a car with their friend. They're in high school that's going to drink and drive. Ugh. I hope they know to call. I hope they don't do drugs. Like, you know, I hope they don't do something stupid on the date. But I hope that they're not going to be harmed just because of their color or just because of their identity or just because someone assumes that they are gay or lesbian and they're not okay with that.
Yeah.
And that's hard. So I think there's a part where it has to be, because on a level, if we're going to talk about Canada and Indigenous people, what the government did and continues to do has dehumanized a whole mass of people, which allows people to think in the way that you're saying that person that you are trying to have that conversation with is that they don't see them like that. Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about slavery and racism and things like that, that wasn't by accident. Mm-hmm. That was systematic. And I say to people, if it was just to dissect it and look on a level of analysis, you're like, wow, decisions that were made in the 1400s are still in full force today. So then people, but because along the way you haven't educated people, is that this is what we did. Mm-hmm. Now they see it as this is how it is. And so they then see people as othered. Right. And I think once you start to see people, and I think that's what, when people saw George Floyd's murder, I did not watch the tape, but when they saw it and heard him cry for his mother, all of a sudden, right? He wasn't this monster of a black man, or however, you know, black men are portrayed in black people. He became human. And I think in the height of a pandemic where people are really being tested, how do you not see him as human? I don't care what color you are. How do you not see that? So regardless, you know, I think it was all over a fraudulent $20 bill. Seriously? Could be thousands of bills. I don't, like, that's a separate thing. But the fact that that happened, I think, really reached inside people and said,
if you don't feel something watching this, then you're not human.
No.
And I think that, you know, it led to, like you said, sort of this, like, eyes wide open, white people are like, holy shit, this is real. Like, what do we do about it? And I think that's where many of us are probably still sort of sitting, like, in this, I don't really know as a white person what my role is and what I can do to help. And I know you're giving some great tips on, you know, looking internally, kind of auditing our own thoughts and preconceived notions and the way that we see cases when we go to home visits. But can we spend a bit of time talking about maybe some solution focused thinking? And
so
I think the Blackout Tuesday was not the ticket, right?
Okay.
And that's kind of where the virtue signaling sort of conversations came up, and this idea of slacktivism. I don't know if you've ever heard of that term.
No, but I love, see, I'm going to just email you. What do you got for me this week, Matt? I think, okay, the stuff that I always give is going to be simple. I'm not asking people, if you want to protest and that's your thing, protest. You want to go and march and do those things? Absolutely. Those things, I think on a continuum, all of those things are necessary. But I don't think that you have to start so big or start so easy. So when we went to the march, the protest that was in Victoria Park, like, amazing, even 10,000 people were there. Because when you were there, I had no clue. Got masks on and kind of walking through. And as we were leaving, Steve, who I do the training with, he had joined my husband, my son, and I. And we were walking. He's like, yeah, this is great. You know, he's just like, so he, again, people, Steve's white. He's like, yeah. And I said, yeah. I said, I don't want to take away from this, because honestly, for my son to be a part of this at 8, for him to see how many people showed up who were not black, who do not look like him, when they did the take a knee, for him to see that, like, that just still gives me chills. For him to see what people can do and how you come together, regardless of your color, if it's wrong, it's wrong, period. And everybody plays a part. That was huge. So I'm not taking away from that at all. But my question was, how many of these people, I'll be happy if 10%. And it wasn't to be critical. It's just the reality that, yes, you came, you showed up when we're not supposed to be on masks. And I said, everybody that I saw had masks on. So I was impressed with that, because that was the fear. So people did that and people came, and some people have, that's trickled off. But my thing is, okay, now when you sit quietly with yourself, what are you doing? So it isn't just with your thought. And I think it's hard. How do you just critique your own thoughts against your own thoughts? You could just reinforce your own thoughts, right? But what are you reading? So I think even at the simple, what are you reading written by someone of the other voice? Not written by a white person, because that's just our indigenous education in, you know, Thames Valley Distance School Board, and before it was London School Board before then. What are you reading from other voices? Are you asking who's not at the table? So as we sit, who's missing? Whose voice is missing? And do they have equal weight when they're there? Don't just do diversity. So you can show us a lovely picture of all these, you know, we got some Asian people, South Asian, we've got some black people, and we put in some women, and that's it. But when they sit, do they actually have an equal voice? Are you listening to their voice? And because it's different, are you listening with an open mind to say, maybe we should be doing things differently? Maybe I should be looking at things differently and bringing those different ways of doing things. If you don't have time to read, I don't have as much time to read as I'd love, then there's no excuse still. Like, YouTube is my friend. You can't read Rahm DeAngelo's book, you can go listen to it on YouTube. If you want to learn about the orange t-shirt, you can actually see Phyllis, the person who's the story's about, talking about it. And there's one where it's a 2-minute snippet. So if you're telling me you can't give 2 minutes, there's so many different things being offered online virtually now as far as different workshops, different trainings. But are you, and as you do it, I'm going to tell you right now, it is going to feel very, very overwhelming. Your brain is going to feel like it's going to explode, especially if it's new information. And that's what happened about 3 weeks in after George Floyd. Some people were saying, enough already. And then the black people and the people of color, like, are you serious? Like, are you serious? I hear you, but you got to be kidding me. Because it felt like we can't fix anything. So I think it's understanding the language, understanding the different terms that come up so that you can engage in the conversation, trying to really hear the other side. Because even for me, there's one person that you had mentioned.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to mention her name.
Yeah, let's bring her up.
And so she...
Candace Owens.
Candace Owens.
And I think for me, we hear in the media, maybe a lot of left, sort of politically left leading stories and spins on things. And I think it's, for me anyways, I was really curious about what is the right conservative viewpoint on Black Lives Matter, on systemic racism. And Candace Owens, I mean, she's a black woman. Let's talk about it.
This will be my take on this, because I did have a black friend send me this, and I didn't have time to watch it. So he's like, "Hey, did you watch that thing? I want to know your take on this." So I went for a run, and about 5 minutes in, I was like, oh goodness, seriously. So I listened to the whole thing, because my thing is, so just so people know, Candace and I would not sit on the same side of the table as far as the debate about anti-Black racism and Black Lives Matters, even though we are Black people. So I think this is important for people to understand that you can't take one person as the one to speak for the people. So my concern with what she was saying is, A, I know who pays you. I don't even want to get into left wing or right wing or right in this. My thing is, what is the truth? So I don't care on which side you sit. So in her dissection of basically saying anti-Black racism doesn't exist, so, and breaking down numbers and basically painting Black people as bad people who just need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And in the entire hour that I listened to her, and I have listened to other people because I think it's important, as painful as it actually is for me, I really need to hear, because, and I sit there with a notepad and I listen and I rewind it back, because I really want to understand. And at the end of all of them, though, that I've listened to, and some of these people have PhDs, so I'm not discounting. These are not like ignorant, uneducated Black people that they picked up off the street and dressed them up and had them, gave them these sound bites. No, these are educated people. However, I struggle with the fact that you're going to talk to me about anti-Black racism doesn't exist, but you have not spoken once about the history. So She in America, if you cannot speak about how communities were circled as to where you will live and where you will not live as Black people, who a bank can give money to or not give money to, right? So how are you supposed to increase wealth? So if you are defined by the area that you live and your school is underfunded and everything else, and then we will patrol you and over-police you, but we'll also pump some drugs into your community as well. How do you talk about all of these? How do you talk about this doesn't exist when, or even if we talk, even if here, if we want to talk about, you know, Indigenous, the situation of Indigenous people, they didn't get this, to this on their own. And people are still alive who went to residential schools. So if you're not going to talk to me about the history and how things were embedded into law.
Yeah.
Right. So it isn't just the people's attitudes. It was people's attitudes who are also able to in capitalism on top of all of it. Right. So when Candace speaks and she's not breaking that down, she's giving stats, but stats that are not aggregated. Again, break it down. What's in those stats? Mm-hmm. I can't talk to you. Like there's no point, because if you're not going to actually base it on factual stuff, then I don't care what side you sit on. There has to be fact. And you have to talk about the history, because we're talking about generational oppression, generational trauma. Mm-hmm. How does that not factor into? And when she wanted to dissect George Floyd, that's the one that I got. Mm-hmm. He was a this, he was a that. He terrorized this woman. Okay. On so many accounts, I'm not the person who says I love someone in death because it caused. No, my thing is, if you're kind of bad, you're bad. But that's separated out. So if we take out any criminality at the time of his murder, he was not a threat to anyone. Mm-hmm. He was not a threat. So then I go back to, if you want to pick at, and I'm not making excuses for crimes that might have been committed, but if you want to go back to, how did that person get there? Did they start off at the same starting point? And if the answer is no, that means the only way to change these things is to go back. What's happening in the community? What's happening in the educational system? What's happening in all these things? For role models, what's being reflected back to them through the media and the television and all of these things that they are consuming? If it's being fed back to them that they are bad, so I think about internalizing the racism and believing as a person of color or person of that marginalized group, the things that are out there in the stereotypes, how does that not impact you? Yeah. So I struggle with Candace.
So it's sort of like a similar with the guy that I almost got in a fight with. Like, if you can't talk about the history, the trauma, the oppression, we can't really have the conversation.
You can't fix it.
Yeah.
You can throw billions of dollars at all of these things and talk about, but again, once you said you've thrown billions of dollars, how's that been divided? How many communities? How many people? How much service can that also provide in that community that's legitimate service, mm-hmm. right? So if you're not going to talk to me about that, and you're going to do sound bites about a stat that you pulled, but you're not going to talk about these statistics,
mm-hmm. it's null.
Then there's a problem. So it's not to say that white people are not being killed by police in situations. They are. Mm-hmm. They are. But the disproportional amounts doesn't make sense.
Right.
So,
and one of the things she said on Ben Shapiro's show was that black Americans need to fix the problems in their community, and that white people need to stay out of the discussion, and that black people have become the author of their own problems. And, you know, I guess that's a bit jarring, you know, white people stay out of the discussion.
I think that there are certain spaces that, yes. And I think as being allies. So, for example, if I'm being brought into an Indigenous space, if I'm being brought into a space, let's say that's the Chinese community, right? I'm not there as a Chinese person or as an expert.
Right.
So really, what am I bringing to the table? So they're going to say, Michelle, we're bringing you because you have a strength in this. Okay, then how do I serve? Do you want my feedback on this particular proposal? Do you want, like, what is it? I'm not leading this. And there will be times where they'll say, Michelle, no, it's just the Chinese community or whatever. I'm like, yeah. Because you need to have your discussions in your space without feeling, and without the other person feeling threatened and thinking, calling it reverse oppression. Let's just call it that. No. For you're wanting a people to heal or to come together, they have to have space to be on their own for certain things. And then you're brought in and your expertise is brought in, right? As opposed to coming and saying, we are the all-knowing. because I think of the destruction, devastation that's had happened to a lot of marginalized communities, there might not be the capacity or the infrastructure to solve it on their own. So what are the things that they're saying are needed and what support is needed, but not for you to come in, because that's how this got here.
Right.
Colonizers cannot fix this, but they have the money, the wherewithal, and controlling or trying to control the resources. So there has to be some sort of coming together, but there has to be an understanding there are certain spaces that it doesn't make sense for you to be in that space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For example, the One Vision, One Voice I talked about before had they had what they called a power up a couple of summers ago. And so it was for Black youth in care. Came together, had a conference in Toronto. So Black youth from all different, some even remote places in Ontario where they are the only Black face walking in their town. So think about the positive impact that had on them to come together with other Black youth that are in care just like them and come together and hear about their culture, hear about their identity, and to share their struggles and how they are being treated as Black bodies in this space. So it was important for them to see Black people leading this, right?
Yeah.
To really legitimize it for them and add strength to it. I could be, I can do, they're doing. And then they did it another one in the fall of that year for Black staff. Again, to be in this body doing this work that oppresses your own community.
Hmm.
Regardless if you're a frontline worker, regardless if you're support staff and just being in this space, right? That oppresses. What toll does that take on you? And then in that space that you are dealing with racism and other things, like real. So my thing is always when Steve and I are working, we always talk about what are we doing in-house? Because if you are not treating others within our own house with respect and equity or trying or having these conversations, I do not trust for a second that you are doing it with the families, which means you're doing harm.
Good point.
Right? So it's not easy.
No.
The reality is after my last birthday, I said to someone, I'm not going to see the changes that I want to see in my lifetime. But I keep going because I'm passionate about it, because I see the changes in staff every day, the emails they send back. And Steve and I do equity breaks. That's the last thing I'll tell you, and then I'll stop talking.
No.
But when COVID hit, and we'd always talked about it. We always before, but it just seemed like, well, we better do it now. We can't do the training. So how do we keep the discussion alive in the agency? How do we keep things moving? And opening it up to people who might not, this isn't about if you've done the training, then you can participate in this. So we've done equity breaks, we call them, and they're videos. We've done a few that are just audio podcasts, and they're anywhere from 10 minutes up to an hour about a certain topic. We've interviewed some staff who are like, equity's kind of the way that they do their work. They've given feedback. We've had a supervisor on who talked about the use of the genogram, and who would have thought that a genogram would have got so much response and feedback from people? People like, oh my gosh, that's how I'm going to use it. And I really made sense to me and how to use it and how to use it also in counseling. And then to talk about centralizing trauma, like you've talked about trauma, but those things are very obvious. They went to residential schools. This was done to them, as opposed to the day-to-day implications of dealing with racism and other forms of oppression. The microaggressions daily, the toll that takes on someone's mental health. So we've talked about that. The last one we did was that featured this week was about the orange t-shirt. We did one a couple weeks ago. It seemed to be well received. People seem to enjoy it. The one on the N-word, because there's confusion around that. So that's putting it out there, and then teams can use it. I know some supervisors have told their teams, I need you to go back and watch a such and such equity break. We're going to talk about it at our team meeting.
Cool.
We've gone to unit meetings. So people are, for the most part, receptive to trying to have these discussions. And you have, the more discussions you have, that's why I said, I don't want to make it really big, because if you can't even have these discussions in your day-to-day or just with your colleagues, you know, like this was in the news and looking at it from that lens, is it a form of heterosexism and talking about it, then you won't be able to apply it. It's impossible. Right? Until you become comfortable. 2 years ago, if we'd said anti-Black racism, white supremacy, like we did it in training and people are just like, what have I entered? Like we're talking about dismantling oppression and they're just like, are these militant people? Like what's happening here? That this has now just become, you know, everyday language and having the conversation, it isn't, I think, to be silenced or feeling that you will be opening up something that you really shouldn't in this space by wanting to talk about it now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of given space to talking about it.
I guess there's some fear of talking about it and sounding stupid or sounding racist or ignorant to some of these things. And
but I think the one thing we talk a lot about and we've done is you come back and you apologize.
Right. You have to have uncomfortable conversations to make change and to...
And why is it uncomfortable? And coming back, look, I've had situations, even though I do equity training, where I've just thought that was just really oppressive what you said, Michelle. And I remember following up with someone like a few days later, and this was in my personal life. And they had no reason, no idea why I was calling them. It literally just, and so I said, what I said was like oppressive. And they're just like, no, I didn't think so. I was like, to me, it didn't matter because, and I said to them, it didn't matter even if you weren't there. It shouldn't have been said. And this is why, like, it seemed that's an okay because it was part of a story. But then when you really break it down, it wasn't necessary. And so apologizing for that and getting used to apologizing or saying, you know, Matt, okay, you called me out on that and you said that was like really, really heterosexist. Okay, that wasn't my intention. So I apologize for that. Can you just explain to me how? Can we have a discussion about that? Mm-hmm. And you'll be like, oh, okay. Well, when you said blah, 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 and this is why, and this is the historical piece to him, like, okay. Yeah, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And now I can, or my intention wasn't that, but it didn't matter what my intention was because that was, this is what the impact was. And thank you. Cause I said to people, it's always a gift because what will happen is most of the time people do not come back and say anything to you. Well, they'll talk about you.
Right.
They'll change their view of you.
Right.
And that might taint other situations. Whereas if they had that conversation with you and saw that you would be receptive. So the big thing is to not be defensive because your first thing is fragility is going to kick in. So that's why I always want people, not that it's the most brilliant piece of, you know, equity writing, but the white fragility just gives you a starting point that as a white person, you can look at it and go, okay, so this was my automatic reaction. Maybe that really didn't fit here. Mm-hmm. And maybe I do need to listen. And then we can have a discussion, right? So you're more open to it without feeling threatened. And I'm not feeling that I need to attack or that I'm on the attack, that this is what came up. So can we talk about that?
I love how practical this all is and just coming
That's
down.
Why I said it's going to seem so simple. What does he want me to say? Because I don't want the big. I just think it's got to be simple, practical. What are the takeaways so that people can go, yeah, I can manage this. So if everyone's doing this, their own little thing and they're expanding out,
mm-hmm.
We can't but move forward, right? And we're going to make mistakes.
And that's, I think, it's risky these days to maybe be saying things publicly. Like we talk about cancel culture and, you know, it's social media toxic, you know, it's a toxic world.
There's got to be a balance.
Yeah.
So I think there's got to be a balance because I look at, so for example, totally unrelated. So the stuff that's happening, you know, Western and COVID, and overall they've been doing well. Past weekend, some students decided they wanted to have a fun in their dorm, have a party. And I said to someone, what if you just expel a few of them? You know, there's a point where you just have to be, this is how serious this is. Mm-hmm. And the ones who are having parties, I haven't heard a lot of, well, no, there was a student on who said she had students on her street that she could clearly see weren't physically distancing, weren't from the same house. Then I think, then you slap some with some serious fines.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
People start to think, I don't think I can afford that. Yeah. Or I don't want to go tell my parents that I'm not going to school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just think that they're, to me, in any sort of movement or something, there are those who are going to be on either end, right? And I think the extremes serve a purpose. It serves a purpose to bring things to light. It serves a purpose in that sense. Will I be on that fringe way over there? That's not me. But I respect it because I think there has to be those who are willing to say, I'm willing to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And to move things along, to open people's eyes, to further the conversation. So I think, but for me, there are these little simple things like anybody can buy this.
The orange shirt story.
Anything.
Yeah.
That's what I said to people. Like, you can Google it. You can go to the library. Steve, the other day before, in prep of us doing it, just refreshing himself with the story, he didn't have the book. So he went online and the person read it. Like, it's narrated. So on certain levels, those things are so accessible.
Yeah.
That you, like I said, there's the library. You can pull out audio stuff from the library. If you have access to Wi-Fi, you can get information like right away and easily, and it doesn't have to be even an hour of your time.
And this is a good segue into kind of getting to the end of our time together, but just, is there anything that you haven't already covered in terms of advice, tips, wisdom for new social workers, new mental health professionals coming into the field, you know, that want to be an ally, that want to help combat racism, and further these conversations?
First thing is ongoing learning. If I'm the age that I am, been black body for all my life, always been anti-oppression before it was even called that, even from a kid, I still see the value and I still get so much from reading and engaging in discussions with people. Do not be afraid to engage in the discussions. Make mistakes. Apologize for your mistakes. Beg for forgiveness. Call people out on certain things in a respectful way and don't be afraid to do that. Those are the simple things. But I would say, if you're still in school, write a paper from the other voice. Another big thing, especially if you're still in school or you're just leaving, is to really, really look at the trauma of oppressions. Because I think it's obvious if someone has been in an abusive relationship or physically assaulted, or they're coming from a war-torn country, but to actually see that someone who is racialized in some way, Asians, Black, Chinese, Indigenous, that they're walking in the world is a constant. And there's certain things that I've realized in doing the training is that, why do I do that? Oh, I do that because I'm trying to present as non-threatening. And I don't even think I'm actively doing it until now that I've really started to analyze what I do in order to do my training better, right? So what is that mental toll on my brain? Because there's stuff happening constantly now. From the time that you have, so as a person who is LGBT, who identifies with that LGBT2S+ community, there are things that are just happening in the background, which means your brain is just functioning all the time in that capacity to survive or to address it. Then when you're trying to sit in class or you're at work, you don't have the same capacity to deal with some of those things as other people do, right? So when we talk about, well, he went to school, she went to school. Yeah, but there was other stuff happening, or they were dealing with these microaggressions, and I don't call it out again. I'm just going to deal. I just go and deal. And not everybody's the same. So when you're a counselor, if you choose to go into counseling, how many counselors have asked their racialized person of another body or identity, what is that like? Right? Because we send youth. I say to people, so you send the youth because he's acting out. He's Black. He's acting out. Where do you send him? They send to a counselor. What counselor? And then what happens when he's just like, he doesn't know why it doesn't fit. Remember, again, a lot of people aren't going to be able to unpack that. Well, I'm here, Matt, because Michelle, I've been dealing with a lot of racial aggression at work, or I just realized, or there's stuff in my past when I was called the N-word and this happened. Like, you might just go, what the? Right? So we send the youth. He or she stops going. And now what do we say? Not following the treatment protocol. They're non-compliant. They're not cooperative. And then they're smoking too much weed. They're doing drugs. Well, they might be self-medicating. So let's address the drugs.
Right.
Let's address the aggression. And let's send them to the white counselor who doesn't have a clue. And no disrespect to them, right? Because they came through this system that didn't say, we might want to look at this. You might want to put this, you know, in your list of things in your toolbox for when someone comes, when the person who's Chinese comes. What does that mean?
So being curious, asking questions, being genuine and wanting to understand and connect with what they've experienced.
And then how is your identity playing into it? Put it on the table.
Right.
I'd be like, I don't know anything about being Chinese.
Right.
So if you mention something, I will look it up. I will come back. I will do my homework. I will always do that for you. And I will tell you what these other bottom lines are and how they're going to intersect with what you're saying is your culture or your tradition. And I don't want to undermine that. We have to make sure that you're moving forward, that your mental health is being addressed. Mm-hmm. And looking at things as to what's a cultural reaction, because I think some of those things get pathologized. Mm. Right? Because we're, if you're coming from a Western community where we're just like,
right.
And then you get someone who's like, ah. Okay, so they were out of control. They were, right. No, they were just expressive. You don't put them with the rest of the people. You're thinking.
So being factual, I guess, is back to that point too of let's look at, rather than coming in with this is an aggressive person, put that to the back.
But why are they aggressive? It's the curious.
Right.
Like one of my, what's the person underlying? Who I always think about is Colette Chapman. She doesn't get it. Why aren't they curious? So when someone says he's aggressive, I'm like, well, why is he aggressive? Well, he hasn't been following through the plan and his parenting is lacking. Why? What's happening? I had one case where the person had like a acquired brain injury and I had to say, I'm sorry, but you want him to do what? Like it was this expectation that it was someone who, there were so many struggles that came with that injury. That to parent in the way that you wanted them to, and then you keep having the same conversation. I kept saying, why are you keep having the same conversation with this person who doesn't have the ability? So you are frustrating that person and making them feel horrible possibly. And that wasn't their intention, but really having to shift it to say, okay, if this is their situation, then how are we supporting them in parenting? Mm-hmm. Do they need other additional supports? Because given the age of this child, this might be too much. Do we need to get another assessment of this as opposed to continually having the same conversation with the person and expecting a different outcome? It's like, well, why is he struggling with this? Well, he's always doing, drugs. Why? Hmm. Nobody grew up. Nobody was a kid and said, you know something, Matt? I grew up. I think I want to get addicted to some opioids.
Yeah.
Not have anywhere to live, have some kids I want to take care of. Like nobody does that. So then I always go to, okay, some people based on those traumas, you know what I mean? There's just not a lot of recovery for that in order to actually parent a child. So I get that. But then for some, what is causing this?
Mm-hmm. It's such a humanistic trauma-informed approach. At the base of it all.
You make it sound so simple.
I'm just trying.
And there we have it. There we have it, people. There you go.
That's all you need to do.
That's all you need.
Some self-awareness, some reading. We're good.
And self-awareness is beyond just that self-awareness.
Right. Like,
you wrote that paper in, your social work course. No, what does that actually mean?
Yeah. Well, I love this. This is good. I mean,
I could do this forever, so you might want to.
I was going to say, we could talk for days about this. I have so many other things I wanted to ask you and talk about, but that's okay. Maybe we'll do a part two.
Thank you. This has been great.
Yeah, this is fun, and it's so good talking to you. And I guess maybe we'll end it there. But
next time we'll be more specific. I feel like we're like.
But it was good. I mean, it focused around equity and around child protection and child welfare and what we bring in as social workers. And I guess if I can I ask you one more question that I always like to ask everybody? Because, I mean, your child welfare is, you see so much, right? And burnout, vicarious trauma, it's something that at some point most social workers experience, especially in child welfare. What do you do to prevent it, to mitigate it, to deal with it, to manage it all? I mean, you also have this other piece of this anti-oppression, and that adds a whole nother lens to the things that you hear and see. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if you have any tips on that.
Well, I don't know if it's going to be anything new, anything that your other guests haven't said before, but I think the huge thing is to, we say have a balance, but to truly separate, like, the work. Like you have to have other things that bring you joy, other things that are not, so that you're not doing this 24/7. And sometimes we slide into that. So how do you slide out and how do you make space to really reflect on that? So whether it's simple things like journaling or listening to music, whatever your thing is, but for me, it's connection with other people. And then there's times when I just need to be by myself. So giving yourself the space and the permission to do that, but it's not all consuming. There has to be a separate thing from that. I think that you have to be able to, and to have people that you can talk with, honestly, debrief with, and recognize you can't save everybody. Mm-hmm. I think that was my easiest thing going into social work. I'm not here to save everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, I honestly was, and I think people were like, what? That's unrealistic. So what are the things that I do really well? What are the things I have to work on when I'm talking like within the workspace, but that there is something separate that brings you joy. There has to be.
Nice. And tailoring
and counseling.
Expectations. Yeah. And counseling. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
So balance, manage your expectations of how many people you can help and what impact you can have. Seek your own supports. Mm-hmm. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. Okay. Well, it's been so good talking to you, Michelle.
It's been fun.
If people want to reach out to you to learn more from you or just connect, is there a way to do that?
Yeah, they can do that. They can do that through personal email.
Okay.
Which is Sista Young. So Sista_Young at hotmail.com.
Okay.
They Perfect. Can do that.
Awesome. That's
Thank
great.
Thank you.
All right, Michelle. Well, thanks again for coming on. And
thanks for having me. This was fun.